we're coming to the conclusion of this chapter, and this is a dream that Daniel's had during the reign of Belshazzar, king of Babylon. And we'll all remember the dream. He sees the great sea, the Mediterranean, and these four beasts come out. The fourth one, however, is different than all of the rest, and we've spent quite a bit of detail looking at the four kingdoms that would arise later, that these beasts are representative of. So we're going to conclude speaking about the fourth beast, most specifically the horns that are on the fourth beast this morning. So there in Daniel 7, let's begin our reading in verse 23. Thus he said, and he's speaking to the angel asking for a further interpretation. Thus he said, the angel said, the fourth beast will be a fourth kingdom on the earth, which will be different from all other kingdoms, and will devour the whole earth and tread it down and crush it. And as for the ten horns, out of this kingdom, ten kings will arise, and another will arise after them. And he will be different from the previous ones, and will subdue three kings. He will speak out against the Most High, and he will wear down the saints of the highest one. And he will intend to make alterations in times and in law, and they will be given into his hand for a time, times, and half a time. But the court will sit for judgment, and his dominion will be taken away, annihilated and destroyed forever. Then the sovereignty, the dominion, and the greatness of all the kingdoms under the whole of heaven will be given to the people of the saints of the highest one. His kingdom will be an everlasting kingdom, and his dominions will serve and obey him. At this point, the revelation ended. As for me, Daniel, my thoughts were greatly alarming me, and my face grew pale, but I kept the matter to myself. So as the angel has identified for us, this fourth beast that Daniel's inquiring about is diverse from all of the others. And what really stood out about this beast that Daniel wants to know more about, and he asks this angel for further interpretation about, are the horns on this beast. And if you'll remember, the fourth beast, which was going to represent the Roman Empire, had 10 horns on his head. And then this strange occurrence occurs. Three of the horns are uprooted. One takes its place, and on this little horn, as it's referred to by Daniel, it has pompous eyes and a blasphemous mouth is how it's described. And so we're going to kind of conclude this portion of the chapter talking a little bit about the horns on this fourth beast. Now, you'll remember, as we've identified previously, other passages in the Old Testament allude to the fact horns, when you look symbolically, especially at the prophetic language of books like Revelation and Daniel and Zechariah and others such as that, horns are representative of power. And the angel identifies for us here, these ten horns on this fourth beast are going to be ten kings that will arise. Now, remember, the number ten symbolizes totality. That's just the symbolic number, symbolic meaning of the number ten, oftentimes, when you're reading biblical literature. So these ten horns represent these emperors of imperial Rome. Now, this 11th horn is going to come up, different than all of the rest, and it's going to uproot three in the process. There have been three basic views in an attempt to explain who this little horn might be that uproots the three, the 11th that comes up, you might say. And who that is? He's identified as having the mouth and the eyes that speaks these blasphemous words. Three main ideas are regarding the little horn, the Antichrist of the last days. This is primarily by those who hold to the premillennial doctrine. And they associate the little horn here in Daniel chapter 7 as the Antichrist. You go over to 2 Thessalonians 2, 8, and 9, and you read about the Antichrist that Paul talks about. That's who they identify. They see that one person, the little horn, and the Antichrist Paul speaks of as the same person. You go over to Revelation 13, which we're going to do later, and that's the same character, the same beast that's identified in John's Revelation chapter 13. And we're going to look at that a little bit later. It's their belief that this little horn, this Antichrist, is going to be the last world power. This reigning dictator in the world that's going to take for himself the honors that only God is supposed to have. And that in this process, he's going to create these laws and he's going to strike out against Christianity and against people who don't submit to his authority and who won't turn their backs on God. And at the second coming of Jesus, he's going to be destroyed. Now, that's one interpretation of who the little horn might be. The other, and Tommy brought this up a few weeks back, or maybe it was more than that, some have identified the little horn as the apostate church and the Pope of Rome, more specifically as, or the role of Pope, as the little horn that rose up speaking these blasphemous things. This view was primarily held by the Reformers, those who were working against the power of the Catholic Church during 13th, 14th, and 15th century, and so spoke very loudly to them, and that's who they related to, the little horn, because naturally was what was taking place during their times while they were alive, and it's something that they were very familiar with. The Pope would thus be the one who places himself at the head of the church as the intermediary between man and God. He would be the little horn that's speaking these blasphemous words against God, claiming honors for himself that Christ simply proclaimed men never to have. And then lastly, third view is one of the persecuting Roman emperors. Or perhaps some view the little horn was representative of all of the persecuting Roman emperors. And so I want to spend a little bit of time talking about that. I want to expound on a theory. And I believe this is biblically sound. However, it is a theory. It's not going to prove anything 100%. But I believe that there's strong evidence that we can identify not just one of the Roman empires, but specifically one. And we'll look at how we get to that process. You can take it for what it's worth. You can agree with it. You can disagree with it. You can ask me questions about it. But let's look at this and let's see if we can perhaps identify the mystery of the little horn and unlock that mystery. The book of Daniel, as we've said from the beginning, is going to make you dig deep. And this is really where that process begins here in 7, where you're looking at these dreams and the symbolic language, all of the odd, strange happenings that Daniel's describing here in his book. And so, in regard to the mystery of this little horn, we have the benefit of seeing literature, looking at history, and seeing if we can determine who it is here that Daniel is speaking of in a futuristic sense. So let's further try to understand this. Hold where you're at in Daniel 7, but turn to Revelation 13. I want to read the first 7 verses there, because I believe the creature that's identified in Revelation 13 is parallel or synonymous with the beast that we're reading about, the fourth beast we've read about in Daniel 7. And now that we have the revelation revealed, that is John's revelation, I believe that aids us as we use history to corroborate and determine who exactly it was this little horn might have been. Revelation 13, let's begin our reading in verse 1. The dragon stood on the sand of the seashore. Then I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having 10 horns and 7 heads. And on his horns were 10 diadems, and on his head were blasphemous names. And the beast which I saw was like a leopard, and his feet were like those of a bear, and his mouth like the mouth of a lion. And the dragon gave him power and his throne and great authority. I saw one of his heads as if it had been slain, and his fatal wound was healed. And the whole earth was amazed and followed after the beast. They worshipped the dragon because he had given his authority to the beast. And they worshipped the beast, saying, "Who is like the beast? And who is able to wage war with him?" There were given to him a mouth, speaking arrogant words and blasphemies, and authority to act for 42 months was given to him. And he opened his mouth in blasphemies against God, to blaspheme his name and his tabernacle, that is, those who dwell in heaven. It was given to him to make war with the saints and to overcome them. And authority over every tribe and people and tongue and nation was given to him. So we come over here, we find John's revelation that he's describing in chapter 13, just as strange as what Daniel's describing for us in chapter 7. But I believe that we can find a lot of parallels that will allow us to understand what Daniel is speaking of in chapter 7 with this fourth beast is the same thing that John is speaking about here in Revelation chapter 13. And perhaps maybe it is representative of the Roman imperial cult that persecuted Christians, but like I say, I believe we can point more specifically toward an individual, and you'll see what I mean as we continue considering some other things. Note the parallels between the beast of Daniel and the beast of Revelation. In both instances, Daniel, and remember, Daniel's speaking of something that's yet to occur. He's speaking of the Roman Empire that's going to come about, and you come to John's revelation, it was the Roman Empire that was in power during the days of John. So what Daniel's speaking of is soon going to be coming to pass for God's people who are living during the days of John when the revelation was written. Both Daniel and both John describe what they're seeing in their visions and in their dreams as a beast. Daniel identifies it along with 3 others. In Revelation 13:1, John says he saw coming out of the sea, and remember, Daniel saw these beasts coming out of the sea. He saw a beast rising up out of the sea. So they both use this similar terminology to describe what it is, what they're seeing. And that's only the beginning of the comparisons. Further, both beasts are blaspheming against God. Now, you'll remember back in chapter 7 and verse 25, this little horn that comes up that's on the head of this fourth beast, he shall speak pompous words against the Most High. So he's blaspheming against God. Look at the beast that John is describing in Revelation. He opened his mouth in blasphemy against God to blaspheme his name, his tabernacle, and those who dwell in heaven. So both the beast in Daniel 7 and the beast in Revelation 13 are blaspheming God. Both of these beasts, you may notice this other detail as well, had 10 horns. Daniel 7:7, this fourth beast that came up from the sea, it was different than all the others that were before it. It had 10 horns. And you come over to John's Revelation 13, verse 1, I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having 7 heads and 10 horns. So both of these beasts, very similar in how they're described, both by Daniel and by John. Not only that, you look at what these beasts then begin to do. Their activity once they come up from the sea. In verse 25 again of chapter 7, this beast is going to persecute the saints of the Most High. Daniel witnesses this in this vision that he receives from God. And as he's describing what's taking place, this fourth beast particular, unlike all of the others, is persecuting the saints of the Most High. Get over there to John's Revelation, verse 7. It was granted to him, that is the beast, to do what? To make war with the saints and to overcome them. Now go back to Daniel 7, and you'll remember, as Daniel was witnessing this, Daniel's describing it as the beast is wearing out the saints of the Most High, and it seems like that the beast is going to win, and that the saints are going to be defeated until God made judgment on behalf of the saints. So you've got the persecution there that both of these beasts are inflicting upon God's people. You've got an empire that's extended for 3.5 years. In chapter 7 and verse 25, and we'll look at the math of this a little bit later, the saints shall be given into the hand of the beast for how long? A time, times, and half a time. Just take my word for it right now, 3.5 years. Revelation 13:5, he was given a mouth, speaking great things and blasphemies, and he was given authority to continue for 42 months. 12 months to a year, 36 months is 3 years, 6 more months, half a year, that's the 3.5 year period. So both of these, in both of these instances, the saints of God are being persecuted by this beast for 3.5 years. Lastly, both beasts are judged by God. Daniel chapter 7:11, he says, I watched then because the sound of the pompous word which the little horn was speaking. I watched till the beast was slain and his body destroyed and given to burning flames. So God makes a very obvious judgment in favor of the saints, and he destroys the beasts for the persecution that they've inflicted on his people. Descriptive there of final judgment that we might say, that is the elements of fire and destruction and the body being destroyed. You go over to Revelation chapter 19. It doesn't occur in chapter 13 where we've been reading, but other events occur regarding the beast, and it culminates here in chapter 19 and verses 19 and 20. Speaking of the same beast that he was talking of that arose from the sea in chapter 13. I saw the beast, the kings of the earth, and their armies gathered together to make war against him who sat on the horse and against his army. Then the beast was captured, and with him the false prophet who worked signs in his presence, by which he deceived those who received the mark of the beast and those who worshipped his image. These were cast alive into the lake of fire, burning with brimstone. And so you've got this judgment here that takes place in Daniel 7 on this beast, and once again, it's judgment by fire. In Revelation 19, the same beast that we've been looking at that John's described, he's cast into a lake of fire burning with brimstone. So you've got in both of these instances a description of a beast that's blaspheming God, a beast that has 10 horns, a beast that persecutes the saints, a beast that does so for 3.5 years, and then finally, in both of these cases, is judged by God. And so these two figures, easy enough for us to conclude when you see it in that light, that Daniel in chapter 7 and John in chapter 13, they're talking about the same thing. The same individual or the same entity, they're referring to the same event. The only thing is John speaking, the fulfillment of what's going to take place is much sooner upon God's people. But it's quite obvious for us to see as we look at it and we parallel these two beasts, they are one and the same. And so we come to this question, who is the little horn? We've got what Daniel told us, which is only part of it. But I believe Revelation allows us to unlock and identify more specifically who that little horn is. Take it for what it's worth, I believe it's pointing to an emperor by the name of Domitian. And I don't just say that lightly, we're going to look at evidence I believe supports this. If you'll remember, there were 10 horns on this beast that came up. An 11th horn came up, uprooting 3 in the process. Now, when you look at the emperors that wore that title, in history, you can go and you can, actually, I believe this came from Wikipedia. You can go and you can look at the emperors of the Empire of Rome. And you look there at the list starting with Augustus, and yes, it existed as an empire before that, but those who first took the title of emperor, the first was Caesar Augustus. And you can read through the list and you can list and you can find out. At the 11th emperor of the Empire of Rome was Domitian, and his reign was from 81 AD to 96 AD. Now, this horn is referred to as a little horn, and as I said, we're going to see, I believe, how the description of the beast in Revelation 13 and in Daniel 7 points directly to Domitian. In chapter 7 and verse 8, what we find out is that this horn is referred to as little. Now, in context to what's going on with God's people, this is very relevant. This is a very big deal. This guy's persecuting the saints of God almost to the point where they're going to be wiped off the face of the earth. However, he's referred to as a little horn. Well, what history would tell us about Emperor Domitian is that from a secular perspective, this guy didn't do just a whole lot. He didn't really stand out like some of the other emperors did regarding his greatness for the Empire of Rome. However, what we do find out is that he was the second after Nero to really begin persecution upon God's people, upon the saints. And what he did is he set a mark. He set a precedent for those emperors that were going to follow after him. He was really the first one after Nero to start this process. Nero, and you can look at the reasoning behind this, Nero's purpose for persecuting Christians was completely different than Domitian's. Domitian's, we'll find out a little bit later, what motivated him to persecute the saints of God. However, he set a precedent that for the next 200 years, what was going to occur among all of the emperors that followed in his footsteps. So when you look at him secularly, yes, his impact was insignificant. His impact was small. And that's maybe why Daniel describes him in this instant as being a little horn, because he just didn't make a real big wave in regard to Roman history. Now, regarding God's people, that's a different story. But he's referred to in such a manner. And Daniel chapter 7 and verse 20 tells us that this little horn was boastful. History once again will reinforce what it is that Daniel has identified regarding this horn. And speaking of Domitian, a Roman historian by the name of Gaius Tranquillus referred to Domitian as presumptuous and unbridled in both act and word. And he also said that he did not hesitate to boast in the Senate. And so what we find out regarding this man's personality, this emperor's personality, he had a very high opinion of himself. Although he may not have done just a whole lot in regard to Rome and its own growth and its own expansion, he had a lot of good things to say about himself. He was a very boastful man, and Daniel identifies for us chapter 7 and verse 20 as this little horn being boastful. Not only that, but what you find out as you read more about Emperor Domitian is that he made a unique claim. And once again, this is a claim that he's setting a precedent for, that all of the emperors following him for the next 200 years during the persecution of the church were going to claim as well. He claimed to be deity. Now, you'll remember we'd mentioned some of the Roman emperors claimed to become gods upon their death. Domitian was really the first one to take this idea that the emperor of Rome was God in this life. Not a son of the gods, but that he was deity. He was, in a sense, a god. And so he made this claim for himself. And as you read through Daniel 7 and you look at this little horn and you consider the boasting that's done, how it's presumptuous and it's described as having this mouth that's speaking these pompous words, not just speaking them to the populace, but speaking them against God. It makes sense when you consider Domitian to be the one, because he was really the first emperor that came along saying, I am a god. And he set this precedent for the others. What greater blasphemy can one say or make than saying, I am God? And so he really started this process of emperors being gods in motion. And Daniel 7:25 tells us he was the little horn spoke very blasphemous things against God. We find out Daniel 7:21 identifies this little horn as an enemy of the saints. Prior to him, with the exception of Nero, Roman emperors were for the most part tolerant of Christianity. Domitian really is the first one that comes along and makes himself an avid enemy. That is, he reaches out with the arm of force in an attempt to destroy Christianity. We're told that the little horn made war on God's people in Daniel 7:21 and was prevailing. You look at what history tells us about Domitian. His own cousin, who had was accused, whether he was or not, was accused of being a Christian, Domitian put to death. Not only that, he exiled, I believe it was, his niece to an island. Whenever she also was accused of what was then called atheism, which we would understand to be called Christianity, he banished his niece to an isle where prisoners, political prisoners, were detained. And very avid enemy against Christianity. History tells us his persecution on those who wore that name was very severe. He's also described by John as the eighth. Revelation chapter 17 and verse 11. This little horn, the 11th horn as it's identified in Daniel 7, this little horn, or the beast that was and is not, is himself also the eighth, and is of the seven, and is going to perdition. So Daniel describes him as the 11th horn. John describes him in the Revelation as the eighth horn. Doesn't seem to be a lot of continuity between that. You may wonder, well, why might that be? The number eight, symbolically, once again, is very meaningful to both Jews and Christians. Circumcision was on the eighth day, if you'll remember. Jews were to circumcise their male sons on the eighth day. You go back to John 20 and verse 26, we'll find out Jesus' first appearance to his disciples. You want to guess what day it was? It was the eighth day. Sunday is referred to as both the first and the eighth day. So the number eight would have had special significance to God's people. So what does the number eight have to do with Domitian? When you consider the fact that numerically he was the 11th. Well, I don't know if you noticed or not, beside all of these emperors, we had the period of time in which they reigned. AD 69 is the year that's referred to as the year of four emperors. You have three men there, Galba, Otho, and Vitellius, all who reigned within this year, AD 69. Their period of time in that position was simply a few months. And so they were very quickly in that position, and then they were removed, and they were all but forgotten from the records of history. Now, because of the fact that they were so insignificant, because of the fact that their stamp upon the great empire of Rome was so meaningless, if you remove those three, and you find out, you count down once again, because of their insignificance, you've got Domitian, who now technically was the 11th, yet jumps up to become the 8th. And so that would identify the list there, you know, excluding those, you would find that Domitian would be the 8th as he's described in Revelation 17. And thus, as the little horn, or Revelation 17, he would be the 8th who would come, and in Daniel 7, he would be the 11th who would be that little horn that would uproot 3. So, you know, take that for what it's worth. Many people look at this and have studied through this, and they've said, well, the little horn is representative of the persecuting imperial cult. And that's what they believe. There's nothing that I can say really to argue against that. But I find a lot of evidence in Scripture when you consider Daniel 7 and when you consider Revelation 13 and you consider the parallels of those two to identify them synonymously. And then you read more through the revelation of John and through Daniel's description of this little horn. A lot of those things point to that particular individual and what history tells us about him. So you can take that for what it's worth, and you can consider that, and you may study that more out yourself. So you might come to that determination on your own. So let me just stop for just a moment. I know that some of that was may have been complicated. Does anyone have any questions on any of that that we've just looked at regarding anything from Daniel 7, Revelation 13, the little horn, the beast?
Domitian, if I'm not mistaken, that timeline works out when John was exiled to the Patmos.
Right. Once again, his hatred toward those who are Christians. John being very prominent in the Lord's church, no doubt. So just another corroborating factor, you might say. Dave?
When you get into stuff like this, and it's true, especially back in those times we were living through these things, we were fixing to go through a bunch of stuff, that really the takeaway is what you're after, and that is that God will prevail.
You're jumping ahead of me, man. You're jumping ahead of me. No, you're fine. No, you're perfectly fine. That's where we're going to end up. And so, no, what you're saying is very important. We don't want to get so bogged down in the details. And personally, I find this kind of thing interesting, you know. But that's not the point of it. As it benefits me as a Christian today, is what Dave was pointing out, and as what we'll allude to a little bit later, perhaps in a little more detail. The takeaway being, God's going to deliver His people. So, yeah, good point there, not allowing me to miss that, because you can kind of miss amongst all of the detail here that we're reading about when you see the horns and the beasts, and you want to talk about all of those characteristics and what they represent. It's good to know, and it strengthens our faith, but it doesn't really say much to me as I deal with, you know, the troubles and tribulations of my own life. But we do find that at the end of the chapter, as it concludes, is that God protects and God provides for His people. So any other thoughts or comments on this particular topic we've discussed? All right, so what we find out is, once again back to Daniel 7, all of that other stuff aside, we find out that the saints are given into the hand of the beast. So accompanying these great blasphemies that are going to come from his mouth, we see that the little horn is going to persecute the saints of God. I like the King James Version rendering for this. It says that he's going to wear out the saints of God. Kind of the idea that you get is just this persistent pressure on a piece of clothing that will eventually just rub a hole through it. It will render the clothing so thin that you can just poke a hole through it. And that's what was going to take place. The emperor was going to persecute the Christians, an attempt to wear them out, to break their faith, to cause them to turn and to worship him and to turn away from God. That was what he was going to do, and the extent to which he would try to wear them out is quite severe. And so this persecution that the emperor was going to place on God's people was going to be relentless, and it was an attempt to cause the people to bend to the will of the emperor. He was going to intend to change some of the laws and the times, and these were the things that the imperial cult was going to later come and try to stamp out, you know, Christianity. And we're told that he was going to be given into their hand for a time, times, and half a time. And I told you, just take my word for that. We're going to kind of see here the math behind that. When I said both in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, you have that period of time of 3.5 years. So you consider the language, a time is a year, times 2 years, half a time. You add all of that up, that comes to 3.5 years. And so we're told that the saints are going to be given into the hand of this persecuting Roman imperial cult for the period of time of 3.5 years. And you may wonder, well, does that have any significance? As most of the things in these visions that we're reading, I believe it does. Where does 3.5 years come from? You find out in Revelation 13, we read that passage where the beast was given authority for 42 months, for 3.5 years. I believe it comes, or James identifies it for us here somewhat in James 5:17. You may wonder, what's James got to do with Daniel and John's revelation? He refers to an event with Elijah, and he's encouraging men to pray and to pray with faith. And he says, Elijah was a man with a nature like ours, and he prayed earnestly that it would not rain. And it did not rain on the land for 3 years and 6 months. To my knowledge, this is one of the only other few instances where you've got this period of time, 3.5 years, identified. And so James says that it was during this period of time when Elijah prayed that it wouldn't rain. It didn't rain for 3.5 years. What happens when it doesn't rain? Times are hard. And that's exactly what we find out. You go over to 1 Kings 18, verse 22. Elijah, he went to present himself to Ahab, and there was a severe famine in the land. Well, why was there a famine? Because Elijah prayed that it might not rain. And it didn't rain for 3.5 years. And so you take this idea, 3.5 years of no rain, it was a time of hardship for God's people. Just the lack of rain, the famine that was brought about, nothing was growing. It was harder, obviously, to find water. It was a time of tribulation for God's people, you might say. However, it was finite. And so 3.5 years seems to be somewhat symbolic of a definite time of hardship that are suffered by God's people. And remember, both in Daniel 7 and Revelation 13, the saints of God are given into the hand of the beast for time, times, and half a time, 42 months, however you want to look at it. They're given into the persecution of the Roman Empire for 3.5 years. Well, is that 3.5 literal years? Probably not. I find the number to be symbolic of a definite but trying time of hardship, you know, as we find out alluded for us by James. So let's end on a positive note as we're almost out of time. We'll conclude in chapter 7. What we find out is revealed for us in this vision is the angel emphasizes in the last two verses. God's people have got hard times coming. And it's going to look like, for a period of time, that the beast, who's yet to be recognized at this point in time when Daniel speaks, is going to win. However, what we find out is that judgment was made in favor of the saints of God. It was going to be for a period of time, but God was going to say, it's enough. I've had it. And the eternal kingdom was going to be given then to God's saints. In contrast to these other kingdoms and these other beasts that we've looked at, all four, it says, were given dominion. They were given dominion, but it was temporary. We see their rise. We see their fall. We see another coming in to take their place. And even this fourth beast in all of its greatness was going to have his dominion removed. Judgment was going to be made in favor of the saints of God and an eternal kingdom, not limited in duration like all of the others that had arisen. An eternal kingdom was going to be given to God's people. And that's the takeaway that David previously mentioned. That's the kingdom in which we are able to be a part. That's the Lord's church in which we exist today. And it's a kingdom that's going to endure unlike those other worldly kingdoms. And even the kingdom in which we live, the United States, in all of its greatness. At some point in time, if this world persists, this nation will fall. Another nation will arise greater than we are and will take its place. But the comfort is that we can be part of a kingdom that doesn't fade away. And we do that when we become a Christian, we obey through faith. And so obviously Daniel has experienced here a very emotional series of dreams. And you can look at the profound effect that this had on him. As he concludes, my thoughts were greatly alarming and my face grew pale. To see and to know that at some point in time in the future, God's people were going to be wore out by this beast. And that it would appear that they're going to be destroyed. No doubt that caused him some apprehension, knowing that God's people were going to endure this. And so you see the effect and the impact that that vision had on him. So that concludes this particular vision. Point being, God's going to give his kingdom, which is eternal, to his people ultimately. And that's how the story ends. So there is comfort to be found in that. Does anyone have comments, thoughts, questions that they'd like to add to Daniel chapter 7?